Next week in Milwaukee, there's going to be a very serious examination of water conservation and the future of the Great Lakes, the life-sustaining resource of the world's largest freshwater system. And two of the people who will be involved in that are with us this hour of the program, and they're involved in this issue all the time. Kathleen Dean Moore joining us momentarily, a philosopher, nature writer, public speaker, and defender of all that is wet and wild. Her newest book is Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, and it gathers testimony from 100 of the world's moral leaders who call us to honor our obligations to future generations. A little later in this hour, we'll be speaking with Jenny Kale. And Jenny works with the Freshwater Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's the director of the Center for Water Policy, and she just organized this really important conference, which came up with recommendations of what we need to do to conserve water, the impact of climate change on the Great Lakes. She will be with us the second part of our program. All hour, you're welcome to join this conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Kathleen Dean Moore was Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Oregon State University in Corvallis, where she taught environmental ethics, philosophy of nature, and a number of courses in environmental leadership. She has written a lot of books. She published a book of essays in 2010. She has written books on river walking, at home in the natural world, and she has been a real force on poetically, really, letting us know why we need to take this issue on from our hearts as well as from our heads. Kathleen Dean Moore, thank you very much for being with us. Hi. Kathleen, are you there? Well, we'll try and find her in a moment. And we certainly, we've spent a lot of time talking about the issue of climate change. And, of course, with last week's demonstrations in New York and the UN conference on climate change, which took place, it seemed this was the appropriate time, again, to look at this very, very important issue. Kathleen will say it's a human rights crisis as it undermines the systems that support human lives, liberty, and also security. And so she has an interesting take on all of this, and I'm sure that many of you do as well. And we do have her with us now. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much for being with us. Hello, Kathleen. Kathleen, are you there? I'm sorry. I don't know what's wrong with our phones. We'll try and reach her again, maybe on another phone line. She, in addition to all of her teaching, she has done some really interesting things. She's the founding director of the Spring Creek Project for Ideas Nature, and she, the Environmental Studies Initiative, which she put together at Oregon State University, is an integration of two important fields when we look at climate change. It integrates science and humanities to provide leadership for a complex time. She will be at this conference that we were telling you about. It's going to be in Milwaukee, October 6th through October 8th. It's Rachel's Network 2014 Fall Retreat, and it will include a number of different people. John Goethe will be speaking, talking about the area's waterways and the history of the waterways, and Jenny Kale will be there as well, director of the Center for Water Policy at UWM. So it should be an important and very, very interesting conference. Kathleen, are you with us now? I just can't hear a darn thing. I don't know what's wrong, but we'll try and figure it out. And also interested in your thoughts about climate change and the moral responsibility. She spoke, Kathleen did, at the People's Climate March rally last weekend and said that the day was a bad day for universities holding on to their investments in fossil fuels insisting, she said, on their right to profit from death and extinction, even as their own scientists warn them that fossil fuels will carry us smoking and stinking to the end of life as we know it on this planet. She called it a great day for justice and the right of all beings to clean air and to clean energy. And she really gets to the very personal, too, and says that in all of the decisions that we make every single day, in terms of what we eat, in terms of how we live on a daily basis, it all is important. There are moral decisions involved. Moral decisions involved in every one of the decisions that we make every day. And Jenny has been with us before. Jenny, just in the last couple of years, took on this new position, really, and as director of the Center for Water Policy at UW-Milwaukee, she organized this conference, which brought together a number of leaders in the whole field of climate change. And they're saying that the impacts of climate change on the Great Lakes system are already urgent and consequential. And they came together with a paper and some calls to action that we need to look at the issue of non-point source pollution, invasive species, agriculture production and consumption, energy production and consumption, and we need to expand our region's renewable energy portfolio, involved everybody, farmers and people who live along the lake and all of that. So we will be talking with Jenny about those issues. Again, for you to join the conversation, and I know that this is an issue that's of importance to all of you. You have thoughts about what it is we need to do about climate change and specifically looking at our Great Lakes. We spent some time, as you'll recall, this summer when Lake Erie had that algae, and it resulted in people not being able to drink water in Toledo and other places of Ohio. So we'll talk about all of that. All right. Should we try again? Yeah. Kathleen? Kathleen, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Kathleen. Great. All right. We're all set now. Kathleen, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. You have called this issue of climate change not only an economic and scientific issue, but fundamentally a moral issue that calls for a moral response. What do you mean by that?
I mean that, yes, of course, there are scientific problems to solve and economic problems to solve and so forth, but really we have to dig down deep and think about this as a moral issue. This is not just, it's not just stupid to wreck the world, but it's not just expensive. It's wrong. It's a violation of justice. It's a violation of human rights. It's a failure of reverence. But what concerns me most of all is that if we let this world go away, if we let it become hot and a miserable place, then we have betrayed what we love the most. We have betrayed the love of we have betrayed the love of our children, and we have betrayed this whole singing world. So I want people to think about how they may respond as full human beings who have the integrity to make sure that this world is not left a ransacked place, but has left a livable world for the people we love.
Mm-hmm. You also pay special attention to the poor and to the voiceless among us, that our use of fossil fuels comes to rest, you say, on the shoulders of the poor and the voiceless. How so?
That's right. I say that it's the people who are feeling the burden of this, or will feel the burden, are the people who have very little voice to talk to us. They are, number one, plants and animals. Number two, future generations, all those children. Number three, they are the marginalized people, the people on the margins of the continents and the people on the margins of the economy. All of these people, although they are the ones who had the least to gain from this proliferation of fossil fuels, they're the ones who are most likely to shoulder the burden.
You gave a very interesting and disturbing speech on Mother's Day in which you talked about it being the day that the atmosphere's carbon dioxide load passing 400 parts per million, the highest concentration the planet has seen in 3 million years. Did the world pay significant attention or a significant amount of attention to that very day and what had happened?
No, I don't think so. It was a memorable day because I think that mothers, grandmothers, parents are the ones who really have the most to defend. I came to this work when I was sitting by my granddaughter's bed, and she was singing herself to sleep, just this little kid. She sings and laughs herself to sleep. And I was mulling over in my mind what I had been learning, and I, in particular, was focused on this call from Stanford scientists that said that if we don't act immediately, then by the time our children are middle-aged, the life support systems of the world will be irretrievably damaged. And I thought at that point, you know, if I love this child, if I say I love this child, then there's nothing I can do that's more important than stopping that from happening.
And you talk about, Kathleen, stopping fossil fuels, which seems like a very tall order. Why do you pay attention to fossil fuels, and how in the world would they be stopped?
Well, the fossil fuels are the reason why the climate is increasing its carbon dioxide load, and therefore why the planet is heating. It's the burning of the fossil fuels that releases that carbon that's been stored underground for so long, as scientists have been telling us for decades. If we can make the transition to clean sources of energy, if we can find ways to heat our homes and get where we need to go without burning things up, if we can find ways to tap into the wind and the sun, then we can stop pouring that, at least, source of carbon dioxide into the air. And I used to think that was going to be hard. And this last year, I've been thinking more and more optimistically that we can do this. We know what it takes. We have the technologies. We have the money. We have maybe gradually the will. And it won't take that much, and it'll happen far faster than we had thought. When I heard President Obama at the United Nations saying that, yes, the world has many, many problems, but none of them is more pressing than the problem of climate change and the need to quickly free ourselves from the tyranny of oil, I thought, you know, maybe the will is about to have some effect. And as for how to do that, yeah, I mean, I think there are a certain number of steps. One is to stop building the infrastructure for fossil fuels. Stop building the pipelines. Stop building the coal, the fracking pads and the exports, the coal export terminals and so forth. That would be the first step. The second step would be to stop the subsidies for fossil fuel. You know, we around the world give $1.9 trillion a year in subsidies to coal and oil and natural gas. I was just starting to think, what if that subsidy were given to renewable fuels instead? What could solar do with that kind of a subsidy?
And tell me, Kathleen, you say you are more optimistic about this. What would make you more optimistic in the past year? We're still doing all those things, aren't we? We're still fracking. We're still building. The Keystone XL has not been decided yet, but indications are that that may go forward. Where are the accomplishments?
Well, if you look at China, who's experimenting with cap-and-trade, if you look at British Columbia, which has a successful cap-and-trade program, if you look at California, which is taking huge steps, if you look at what the EPA is doing to reduce the emissions from coal plants, I think that things are starting to happen. And I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, and I don't want to overstate the case. But after doing nothing for so long, it seems that things are starting to happen. And when things start to happen, I think we're going to reach a tipping point. And the tipping point that we're approaching very quickly, I think, is a financial one, where the cost of the fossil fuels will become far, far greater than the cost of replacing them with renewables. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm no economics professor. I'm a philosophy professor. So people will need to look this up for themselves. And when I saw, somewhere between 250,000 people marching to the United Nations in New York, I thought, not only can we do this, but we're developing the will to insist that it be done.
It was a huge demonstration, wasn't it, Kathleen?
It was so exciting. I was in Ohio with my mother-in-law, who's 94 years old, and we were watching the coverage on television, and I felt so buoyed. I felt so encouraged that finally I thought that we had reached the point where we can start doing something. Mm-hmm. The silence is over. That's what I felt.
You also, however, talk about the fact that in the last major elections, the top five contributors were big oil, all of them.
Yeah, the climate crisis is also a crisis of democracy. Plato said it a long time ago, if I can dig into my philosophical past. He said, you know, he wasn't a big fan of democracy because he said that politicians could always buy votes, and that he said that democracy therefore always devolved into a plutocracy, a rule of the rich, and that plutocracies, the rule of the rich, always devolved into anarchy because the people wouldn't put up with it anymore. And so the question that we have to deal with right now is, are we going to, from the plutocracy where we presently are, the rule by the rich, the rule by the great corporations, are we going to move back towards a democracy, or are we going to actually take the next step into the kind of chaos that we would most fear?
Kathleen Dean Moore is our guest this hour. She's a philosopher, a nature writer, a public speaker, and defender of all that is wet and wild, she says. We're talking about the moral aspect, the moral issue of climate change, and she says that it calls for a moral response. Would you share her optimism that within the last year, perhaps because of the massive numbers of people we saw in New York last weekend, that we are reaching a point here where we may change how we think, that the technologies are there for renewable energy, and that we may indeed be moving to that. Would you agree with her? And what does this mean to you? I think it's an interesting question that that climate is fundamentally a moral issue, and it calls for a moral response. Think about that for a second, and tell me if you agree that it is a moral issue and what a moral response would be to the issue. Coming up next week in Milwaukee, October 6th through October 8th, a special conference on water conservation and the future of this life-sustaining resource. And it's going to take place on the shores of Lake Michigan. As you know, the Great Lakes are the world's largest body of fresh water. Later on in this hour, we will be speaking with Jenny Kale, who's director of the Center for Water Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She convened this very interesting conference just a little while ago at Wingspread, and talks about all those who gathered, scientists and conservationists, what their recommendations were for what needs to happen to counter the effects of climate change on the Great Lakes and to clean the lakes as well. So that's coming up. Phone lines are open for you momentarily. Our number again is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, you can use that, is talk@wpr.org. Leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen Dean Moore is with us for a few more moments, philosopher, nature writer, public speaker. A newest book is Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, which gathers testimony from 100 of the world's moral leaders who call on us to honor our obligations to future generations. Welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number. Kathleen, before we go to phone calls, when you talk about this being something that we take in our own hands, that we are making moral decisions, would you say, every day in terms of what we eat, in terms of our use of transportation? There are lots of decisions that are directly related to this issue, aren't there?
There are. Every decision that we make is a decision about how much climate is going to go into the air. And we define ourselves by our decisions, don't we? And so what I do is I call for people to a kind of a moral integrity where they make a life that is the embodiment of their values. What do you care about the most? What do you love? What do you love too much to lose? How are your decisions affecting that? And then how might you reimagine a way of living that would most embody your love for the children or for the place or the other, whatever you all hold most dear? People tell me it's too late. I hear a lot of despair out there. I hear a lot of people saying, nothing I can do, it's all too late. And I worry about that a great deal. It seems to me that I agree that blind hope is not appropriate, and that gives us a kind of moral abdication, too. If everything's going to be fine, I don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But blinding despair is a kind of moral abdication, too. If there's nothing I can do that'll make a difference, I don't have to do anything. So hope or despair, I don't have to do anything. And that is a fallacy. That's a fallacy, a false dichotomy, because, of course, between those two extremes, there's this broad ground, this broad moral ground that is called integrity, which is doing what you believe is right because it's right, not because you think you might be able to save the world or stop fossil fuels, but because you believe in it and you think it's right. And I think we're called to a kind of integrity where we act lovingly towards the earth because we love it, and we don't use up too much of the Earth's resources because we don't believe in taking more than our fair share. So that's the sort of call I would make to people who are wondering, you know, what can I possibly do that will ever make a difference?
Let's go to Brenda in New Berlin. Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
Hi.
To piggyback off that, I guess I've thought for many years that it's surprising that that people that, you know, believe in God, that believe in creationism, that they don't embrace this, that they're not more outraged about the damage to creation, you know, to God's things. I mean, when I'm, you know, in nature and I see just the wonderful, just amazing things around us, just, you know, like the monarchs that are in peril and everything that's in peril. And it's, you know, if you believe in God and you love God, then how can you turn your back on his creation? How can you... you know, how can you use it up and just selfishly destroy it for future generations and, you know, just think that that's a right?
You know, I think that's a really well-stated argument. I think you're absolutely right. You know, if God created this world and if God pronounced it good and again he said, and it was good, he's not indifferent to this world. And so the prospect that we might lose 50% of the creatures that God created by the end of the century, one out of every two, and the fact that we're going to be soon tearing the pages out of our field guides, one after another, and living in a much impoverished world, it seems to me to be an act of irreverence beyond imagining.
Thank you, Brenda, very much for the call. What's astounding to me is that all the brilliant minds who could do something about this haven't fully realized the urgency of this, that everybody should be asking, particularly the people who make decisions, what the morally correct thing is to do, that, you know, the people in the oil companies, the people who are building pipelines, the people who are running government, everybody can ask the same question, right?
Well, that's absolutely right, and this is one of the frustrations, is it that there used to be climate deniers that were part of a problem, but now there's two kinds of climate deniers. There's the old ones and the new ones. The old ones, I don't think that's much of a problem anymore. Apparently, about 9% of the populace just plain doesn't believe climate change is happening, and that's about the same percent who believe that Elvis is still alive. So they'll get the message after a while. The ones that really concern me are the new deniers, and these are the ones who say, yeah, I understand that climate change is happening, but, you know, I've got to live my life, and there's nothing I can do. And it's these people who are already concerned who need to mobilize and who need to express in their lives and in their messages to Congress and in their conversations with their neighbors that there is an urgency to this, and it's a moral urgency.
Let's go to Anne in Duluth. Hi, Anne.
Hi. My dad and mom were pretty active environmentalists, and I can remember when my children were small, my dad would get up at a meeting and say, I'm here on behalf of my granddaughters. I'm a little emotional because my dad is now gone, but I remember at the time thinking, wow, you know, when my kid grows up, this will no longer be a problem. And I'm 63 now, and obviously I was wrong about that. But what I want to say is that I think people sometimes get scared off the topic because they think they have to be scientific or environmental science experts in order to speak up or talk. And I just want people to know that they don't have to be. You can join a group, you can read, you can go online, and you can learn about these things. And you don't have to be an expert to show up at a rally. We had one in Duluth last week, and we walked out at the new zoo and saw the effects of a terrible flood we had here 2 years ago. So I just really want to stress to people that your involvement doesn't have to be 40 hours a week. Whatever you can do is good. Write to your legislators, send a letter to your editor, walk in one of these rallies, join a group, and learn.
Kathleen?
Exactly, and so beautifully put. One of the things that was interesting about that climate march were the signs people had that said, I am fighting climate change for, and then there was a blank, and people could write in their motivation. And so many of them, as your father did, said, I am doing this conservation work, I'm doing this environmental work for my children and my grandchildren. It was a beautiful thing to see.
Thank you, Ann, for the call. Paul in the UP, hi.
Hello?
Hi, Paul.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay, how are you?
Yeah, see, I think that I'm 24 years old, and I just graduated from community college and out in Washington, Ann Arbor, and I just don't think that common sense, you know, operates in the political atmosphere of things, because, you know, you look at, you know, the Great Lakes water system and how these private corporations can buy water and then bottle it or do whatever they're doing with it, frack, who knows. But then where does that money go? We have a waterway that's completely contaminated, and then we have to pay out these people that live in the city have to pay all this money to have water. And, it's who's to be blamed for the water to be being, you know, undrinkable to begin with? And why can't that, you know, if they have to sell the water off, make bottles or whatever, why can't they just put that money in a pot and leave it for the impoverished people in the area? It's just that there's not a whole lot of common sense that's ruling the land right now, in my opinion.
Kathleen?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned common sense. You know, rationality, the smart thing to do, the sensible thing, the economic thing to do. And when that sort of thing occurs, the question always is to ask, just as you are, why is that? Where are the disturbances or perturbations that that prevent people from doing the smart thing? And I think that we do need to look at the rules that govern what corporations are allowed to do, and we need to think clearly about the ways in which the poisonings are harming us, and I think that in the end what we need to summon is outrage so that there are things that become unthinkable. Poisoning water should be absolutely unthinkable. Poisoning money for the sole purpose of making a profit should be absolutely unthinkable. So when we think about common sense, there are things that are simply unimaginable that people would do. So I think it's going to call for people to start talking about what we do that is so stupid and so wrong in all the ways that you mentioned, Paul.
Thank you, Paul, for the call. And finally, after the massive march and the UN talking about this issue, and there will be a major conference in Paris, what do you see as the most effective strategy for people who are concerned about this issue and maybe marched in New York and want to keep it alive until the world's leaders again take it on in Paris?
You know, John Kerry said an interesting thing. He said, people, make us do this. In other words, this is a democracy. We're taking our lead from you. We're not being leaders at this point. We're being followers. And all you people out there, all you grassroots people, have to step up and be the leaders. You have to step up and make us do the right thing. And so I think that's our job. That's our task right now. We got to put our government officials on speed dial, and we have to constantly, in every way we can, if it's sending them pictures of your grandchildren, if it's taking off the web a picture of their own grandchildren, if it's, pardon me, if it's posting petitions, if it's marching, if it's sending letters, all these different ways we have to make them understand that this is what we want them to do, this is what they must do, or they will be out of office.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Kathleen, for being with us. Kathleen Dean Moore, philosopher, nature writer, public speaker, author of a number of books. The latest is Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril, which gathers words from 100 of the world's moral leaders who call on us to honor our obligations to future generations. We're going to be talking about water, the next part of the program. Our conversation prompted by a conference which is taking place in Milwaukee next week, Water and Its Ripple Effects. It's October 6th through the 8th in Milwaukee, and we'll have more information about that fall retreat on our Facebook page. Joining us now, and she knows a great deal about water in the Great Lakes, is Jenny Kale. She has been in the Milwaukee area for a couple of years now. She is director of the Center for Water Policy at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. And she really has traveled all over the world looking at frictions over water rights in the Nile River, Uganda, to Cambodia, China, India, Japan, and Mexico. She convened a very interesting conference at Wingspread recently in which the issue of the impacts of climate change on the Great Lakes system were examined by a number of experts, and they came up with some recommendations that we will be talking about. Jenny, thank you very much for being with us again. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having this important conversation.
Yeah. Well, it was a very important conference, too. First, though, I'm just interested in these travels that you've taken, Jenny, all over the world to look at the issue of, in essence, kind of a water war. Mm-hmm. Where have you gone? What did you see?
I have been to all of those places that you mentioned, and one of the interesting things that I saw was how the consumption patterns of the global economy are affecting local communities, and I think it speaks to the moral question that you were just discussing with some of your listeners and with Kathleen.
Yes.
And I think one of the moral issues that we have to address at the global and the local level is our consumption-based economy. And so as I was traveling, I was seeing the consequences of our consumption-based economy on societies that have very, very few environmental rights and yet are suffering some of the greatest consequences of climate impact. And I would say that was a pervasive theme in some of my travels abroad. And certainly that resonates with anyone who's dependent on water for food or their livelihood on a daily basis. So that made quite an impression on me. It also made me think about the moral implications of selling off parts of our natural resources. These are considered parts of our commons, and our common survival is dependent on how we steward those natural resources. And I've been to many places worldwide where they're not stewarding those resources in a sustainable or responsible manner, but they are selling off parts of those resources to private enterprise and private interests in order to continue to feed our consumption-based economy.
And they're selling them off. Who's buying it? They're selling it off to who?
A lot of energy producers.
Really?
Right. A lot of manufacturing firms, a lot of raw materials and natural resources. Mm. Rare earth elements are very critical for technologies and a variety of things that we need. But the process of extraction, which is also a very water-intensive process, is greatly contaminating the Earth's water. And so we would need to be able to extract those resources in a more responsible way.
You gathered a number of people, and if you would get a little closer to the phone, or mm-hmm. your level's just a little low,
that'd
be, there we go, much, much better. All right, very good. Tell me who you gathered for this meeting at Wingspread, because you came up with a set of recommendations of what we need to pay attention to, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering who is in the room to make the recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Well, we pulled together a group of Great Lakes experts, so they're from a variety of fields, everything from politics to economics, to biology, to atmospheric sciences. We also had a lot of decision makers in the room, representatives from the EPA and the USDA, and a variety of stakeholders in the Great Lakes system. So it was a great group. Everyone collaborated extremely well because we all share the same general value of protecting our Great Lakes. So we recognize the Great Lakes system as vast and vital, but also fragile, and that's something that our scientists were very helpful in determining, is what thresholds have we crossed, what thresholds should we not cross, and how can we have some science-based targets to achieve in order to steward these Great Lakes for long-term sustainability.
Mm-hmm. These are such a precious resource. I want to be reminded every day of the fact that this is the largest freshwater supply the Great Lakes in the whole world. They're vital.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's 21% of the world's
wow.
surface freshwater. So that's a fifth of all of the world's surface freshwater is right
Amazing.
Here in the Great Lakes system. And it's also 84% of North America's surface freshwater.
Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. You said at this conference, I believe, that the impacts of climate change on the Great Lakes system are already urgent and consequential. What are they, Jenny?
Yes, those consequences are already urgent. And some of the consequences fit into shore health, habitat health, non-point source pollution, algal blooms, invasive species. But we're also seeing some great consequences already for agriculture and energy production. So we need to look at our production and consumption patterns of agriculture and energy. For example, with increased climate change, we'll have increased floods as well as increased droughts and increased crop damage. So we're going to have to look at how to adjust to that variation.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Jenny. I know we have a caller who wanted to talk more about agriculture, so we'll get right to that. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. The people that she convened to be at this conference came up with some recommendations, and Jenny will talk more about non-point source pollution, invasive species, agriculture production and consumption, and energy production and consumption as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and Abe in Milwaukee, we thank you for waiting. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'd like your guest to respond to the following question. My understanding is that the greatest cause of greenhouse gases is the deforestation caused by global agricultural industry, particularly for production of beef and pork, and how those things, how that affects our water supply. And my personal response is that about 3 or 4 years ago, my wife and I have become about 90% vegetarian. And the end result of that is that, I've lost 30 pounds. I'm much healthier. I'm off all of my meds. It's better for the earth. It's better for my children. And that's my personal moral response. And I'll take her response off the air.
Thank you, Abe, for the call. Jenny.
Yes, agriculture is energy intensive. Excuse me. And it's also highly water intensive. As you know, one of the most water intensive agricultural products that we consume is beef, by a long shot. So there certainly is much more water that goes into the production of the beef as well as the production of the corn for the beef than most people recognize. So it is a very environmentally responsible thing to do to cut down on those meat products. Another concern, obviously, is the pollution that comes through non-point source runoff from some of those agricultural operations as well. And Wisconsin is working pretty hard to find some ways to address that. But the current reality is that we have a lot of toxic runoff from agriculture into our stream system, which eventually gets to our groundwater and our lake system. And that is having quite a serious effect.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Abe, for the call. And in another area concerning agriculture and climate change, I know that the conference keyed in on what's happening to growing seasons, mm-hmm. that they may be longer, which everybody's thinking, oh, that's a terrific thing, but then you have to use more water and you have to use more fertilizer, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's a very good point. So the growing season has already been extended in the Great Lakes region and in Wisconsin as a result of climate change. So we're looking at that becoming even longer in the future with exacerbating climate change. And that's not necessarily a negative thing. We will be able to grow more crops. The problem is we will also have more floods and more droughts and more crop damage. We will also, with drought in other parts of the country, in California and Texas and large agricultural producers, as they're experiencing extreme droughts, the demand to increase our agricultural production in this area is a great economic opportunity. But we do have limits to our growth. We have limits to what we can produce, and we have limits to what we should consume. And so I would suggest, as the conference did, to make sure that we have some policies in place to govern that growth so that we steward the soil and the water responsibly so that we can grow agriculture sustainably. But the demand on that increasing growing season will be very high.
Mm-hmm. Do we face a problem that the problem we saw in Lake Erie could affect other Great Lakes where people couldn't drink or the water or bathe in the water in Toledo and other Ohio communities, Jenny?
Yes, we do face that challenge.
We do.
It is a reality, and it is something that we are going to experience much more frequently than we have in the past, and it is a serious challenge. It also presents the opportunity to get a little bit more impactful change in the future because it will directly affect people. It's great inconvenience to have children getting sick from drinking the water or to have boil orders or, you know, to have to prevent your animals from swimming in lakes so that they don't get sick. And that will reach people in a way that some of the more abstract information will not. So I do think we need to use the opportunities that we've had with those terrible situations to create proactive change so that we can avoid that in other areas, particularly because so much drinking water comes out of the Great Lakes system.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very fortunate to have that asset. It would be a real shame, and as Kathleen would say, it would be it's a moral hazard. Right? It's a value. If we value being able to drink water out of our lake systems, then we should not be dumping garbage in it, which is a very simple solution on the surface. Right. If it's toxic, don't put it in the water.
Right. Right. Jeff is next. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, are you there?
Everything got very quiet. Yes, I am here. I can hear you now.
Okay.
We're wondering why there isn't more education for the general public when it comes to using biofuels, which we've found are sustainable. My family has been using biofuels, whether it's biomass, wood-burning equipment, or E85 ethanol in our cars. And we see that there would be a big market for small engines that would work well on biofuels. And I guess I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a good idea in general. We do have to recognize that some biofuels are more energy efficient and more water efficient to produce than others. Some there is not actually a great net gain, but for many others that's a great resource along with other alternative energies. And I think it speaks to breaking the tyranny of fossil fuels that exist now. Breaking that paradigm is difficult, but it does take action, as you mentioned you have taken, in order to get people to see that it's viable and advantageous. And as more of those successes are demonstrated, I believe more people will sign on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, Jeff. Our number is 800-486-8655. Do you share Kathleen's stated optimism the last half hour that she really has sensed in the last year that things are changing, and when it comes to a moral obligation that people are signing in on saying, yes, we do have a moral obligation, or not, Jenny? Do you think that we're not? Are you as optimistic as she?
I am optimistic. I might not be as optimistic as she, but I am optimistic. And there are a couple reasons for that. And one is the debate that she's championing, which is as we bring the moral debate into the question, I'm much more optimistic that we're going to be able to solve these problems. Because if we leave it to just being a political and economic debate, we're not going to make as much progress as quickly. So I'm encouraged by that, and I'm encouraged by people recognizing that we do have a moral obligation to future generations, and we do have a moral obligation to survive, in my opinion. And as we're facing these serial climate crises, we do need to promote more systemic change. The other point of optimism that I find is the environmental movement is the largest movement in the world historically. There are a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds in a lot of different countries that are fighting for the same thing. And I would say that's actually unprecedented in human history. I think another point of optimism is that as we start to see this as part of a human rights issue,
mm-hmm.
we will be able to rally because there are some great injustices that are happening as a result of climate change. And I think it's important that people are starting to recognize that if we value the challenges that our future generations are going to have to face, that we should be taking action now to minimize the damage that they're going to have to deal with.
And outline some of those injustices.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the people who are often least responsible for contributing to the consumer-based economy are often those that pay the highest price in dealing with climate change, and at the local level as well as the international level. So there's some great injustice there.
Andrew, our next caller in Racine. Hi.
Hi. I was just calling to make a comment about, I've been reading about waste-to-energy plants, and I've noticed that a lot of places overseas have been getting more involved in it by burning waste to produce electricity. And I was trying to figure out why the U.S. hasn't gotten too much more involved with it. I've only read we haven't really built any new ones since 1995. So that's kind of one of my questions, like, why haven't we kind of looked into that?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. That's not my area of expertise, but I can tell you there are some innovative projects that are being initiated in that area. What we need to do is scale up those projects, right? Because as we are one of the most wasteful societies in the world per capita, that is certainly a challenge that we do need to address.
Let's talk a little bit more about, you mentioned this non-point source pollution. From the conference came this thought, which makes sense, that the Great Lakes must be approached as one watershed, which essentially it is. What kinds of pollution heading into the lakes is of most concern to you, and how do we stop that from entering the lakes?
Mm-hmm. Well, that depends upon which scientist you ask, but I can say there is a bit of consensus emerging around the issues with phosphorus and not overloading our water system with phosphorus, which at toxic levels can kill off entire ecosystems. So we're working on that with the new phosphorus legislation in the state of Wisconsin, so I'll be very curious to see how that evolves. But again, that goes back to what I was saying about not dumping garbage in the water. If it's toxic, don't put it in the water, regardless of what chemical it is or where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Pat is next in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest if she knows anything about salt marshes, because I had heard that they are better for our environment than the rainforest, and they can produce more effect on our environment than the rainforest. If you could tell us something about salt marshes, because mm-hmm. we should have them on both sides of the country with both oceans.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be near ocean fronts.
The extent of what I can tell you about that is what you just articulated, but I know who knows, so I can get them in touch with you.
Hmm.
I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's talk a little bit more. Some of the callers have brought up this renewable energy and fuel being one of the biggest reasons that we have climate change and these greenhouse gases, how we generate and how we use energy, mm-hmm. which certainly has a huge effect on the health of our Great Lakes and our water, and I mean, it's all connected.
Mm-hmm.
From the conference that you spearheaded, what did you see as the most promising possibilities here, and how rapidly, Jenny, do you think we need to move off fossil fuel?
I think we need to move off fossil fuel immediately. I know our emissions continue to increase every year, and that is what will have the worst long-term consequences. So I think we need to move to that transition immediately, and I think there are important incentives that we can put in place to expedite that transition. I think we need to end our reverence for fossil fuels and move to fuels that are more sustainable. I do find some optimism in that I don't think we have much of a choice about that. We're going to have to find a way to make that happen, and our best hope really is to expedite that process as much as we can. We can do that in the Great Lakes by having a more comprehensive and better integrated energy policy in terms of how we produce energy and how we consume energy and how we transport energy and energy waste in the Great Lakes system. The group was generally concerned about how it is we produce and consume energy, but also transporting it through the Great Lakes presents some dangers of its own.
Mm-hmm. Judith is next in Wausau. Hi, Judith. Almost out of time.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes.
Okay, sorry. It's a little difficult to hear you. I just wanted to bring up the point that both with the last speaker and this guest, I do enjoy your program very much, and they've been very informative, but we seem to be talking around the issue. I hear a lot about how we want to reduce consumption, how we want to make consumption more sustainable, et cetera, et cetera. I think we need to go back to what Paul Ehrlich brought up in the population bomb. There are too many of us, and we need to do everything that we can to limit populations and make the population fit the environment or ecosystem in which it is placed, by which I mean the human population.
Jenny, what do you think?
Yes, I agree with that. I think if we don't do it voluntarily, the natural environment will not be able to sustain us. We will reach growth limits that have surpassed ecological thresholds, and we will not all be able to survive that. We're already having many climate-related tragedies in the present. Those will certainly become worse in the future. So I agree. Population control is essential because as the population increases, we have more people who demand food and demand energy and demand consumer goods. So that will naturally increase consumption.
Thank you, Judith, for your call. And thank you very much, Jenny, for being with us again.
Okay.
Jenny Kale, our guest this part of the program. Again, this conference will be taking place in Milwaukee next week, Water and Its Ripple Effects. More information about that on Facebook, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Scott Myers for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee.